in that moment where the brain is predicting, let's say, anxiety or craving or whatever the emotion you want to change, and it gets something different, that's when a fascinating thing happens in the brain. It literally unlocks the memory and then puts in the new information.
83% of Americans identify as not very happy, which can hold you back and negatively affect your relationships and your business. On this podcast, we discuss the proven steps to happiness so you can restore balance and rekindle your joy.
Welcome to another episode of How to Be Happier for Entrepreneurs. I'm always excited, but this time I'm really, really excited. Our guest has an incredible background in helping change the mind and heal people and bring freedom and happiness. So welcome to the show, Melissa. How are you today?
I'm good. A little cold here in New York City, but I'm getting warmer.
I'm ready for summer. So as we always do, let's just jump right in. What is the unconscious mind and what roles does it play in our lives?
Starting with just a little question, Arya.
Yeah.
What is the unconscious mind? Well, we're still probing that. What is the unconscious mind? In my world, the unconscious mind is everything that we are not consciously mediating. So the unconscious processing, the adaptive unconscious that is always operating every moment of every day, even when you're sleeping. So the unconscious comprises basically your immune system, endocrine system, all of the systems you don't have to consciously mediate, but also all of the, well, let's put it this way, you're being bombarded by millions of bits of information every moment. From internally, externally, we can only be conscious of, research indicates, about 40 of those bits, which means our adaptive unconscious is processing all of these bits of information, looking for relevance, looking for what matches our prediction system, which the brain runs on prediction. That's how it functions. That's how we can function. And so in my world, being a hypnotist and a coach of the unconscious mind, what I'm doing is I'm trying to utilize sometimes the conscious mind to influence the unconscious system, sometimes different ways of kind of momentarily or maybe a little longer taking the conscious critical aspect of the mind, the default mode network of the brain, and kind of shoving that aside while we can then access kind of all of what you know that you don't know you know. Right? So if you think about long-term memory, if you think about most of your limbic system, emotional system, your even working memory, so much of it is outside of conscious awareness. So it's a big question you started with, and people are still, scientists still consider this the hard question, really, of what is consciousness? What makes us conscious? Where is the system? We're still arguing about that. What it isn't in my world is the old Freudian view of this deep, dark reservoir of all of these death instincts and things like that.
So what's the good and the really ugly of the unconscious brain?
Well, I mean, the good and the ugly, it really depends on context. Mainly, it runs on prediction, which means you are behaving today based on how you've behaved. You are feeling today based on how you've felt. And that is how the brain knows to function. So for good or bad, right? So sometimes that's fantastic, depending on what it is you've practiced. Sometimes you've been practicing anxiety and self-doubt and all of these things, and that is your go-to operating system. So for good or bad, you get what you practice. The brain definitely takes the shape of your experience and what you do. So for good or bad.
So you've helped hundreds, if not thousands of clients over your career, right?
Yeah.
How many of those clients was their unconscious mind was helpful to their life? And how many of them came to you because of their unconscious mind, but they didn't know it?
So every single client and every single person that has not been my client or has yet to be my client has been helped by their unconscious mind. You can't walk across the damn floor consciously.
Yeah.
You have no idea what goes into moving a system like your body. I mean, even just to stand up requires so much processing in so many different ways that you couldn't handle it consciously. So everyone's been helped and can function in the world and can learn new things because of their adaptive unconscious processing. And for the people that get stuck and come to me for a problem, be it anxiety or a phobia or a habituated pattern they want to break or a habit they want to make, all of them, again, are mediated through an unconscious habituated system. So I think in terms of practical neuroscience, right, that is what I do. I teach people how to change their brain. I teach them really short and interesting techniques and self-hypnosis and all of the things that research indicates are the fastest and easiest ways to organically change.
So on that note, can you explain what self-directed neuroplasticity is and how it can help stop negative spirals and effectively rewire the brain?
Sure. So neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to change. It's always changing. Every time you learn something new, it can be rewiring certain old concepts. Self-directed neuroplasticity is where you really take the reins of it. You use your conscious mind in a bunch of different ways to strategically change your brain. So when I say self-directed neuroplasticity, it's more a system of brain change that I teach to my clients, right? I give them a bunch of different ways to very rapidly interrupt their habituated pattern. If you think about the brain going down an old pathway, that is just, it's a habit. You don't even have to consciously mediate it. It's typically not consciously run. But as soon as they start to feel the old feelings or the impulses to do the old things, as soon as we can get them at the very front end of that pattern, I teach them how to thwart it, interrupt it with all these different techniques, which also happen to be down-regulating techniques for calm, or the techniques in and of themselves have anti-anxiety properties, affect regulation of all sorts. And so what happens is we interrupt that pattern and then we kind of steer the brain in a different way. We create new neural connections, right? We want to foster those connections through repetition. So that's one form of the self-directed neuroplasticity. It's being able to really take control of your own brain change.
Does this take like years to do?
No. No, it doesn't. It's funny. A lot of this goes back to the earlier work of Jeffrey Schwartz, who wrote a book, The Mind and the Brain, which I don't necessarily recommend that one for lay people, but you can read a book called You Are Not Your Brain or Brain Block. And he worked with severe obsessive compulsive disorder patients. And what he found was even after like 4 weeks of doing not what I do, but interrupting the pattern, he wasn't a hypnotist and he didn't have all these techniques. So it took a little bit longer, but even still, they could see the brain changing after just a couple of weeks. And I think the study, I could be wrong, was about 4 weeks, could have been six, where they looked at their brain in a brain scanner in the beginning. They saw the OCD kind of system. And then 4 to 6 weeks later, I can't remember exactly, it looked like a totally different brain. So, and that was severe OCD, people that couldn't get out of the house.
Wow.
And he didn't have the techniques and hypnosis like what I train people to do change work in. I mean, primarily at this point, I'm a trainer. I teach clinicians, I teach coaches, I teach change workers how to do this work. And I still see clients because I feel like that's my laboratory. You know what I mean? So, but my biggest reach, I guess, through books and things like that is to spread it around so that more people can have access to being empowered enough to change their own mind, change their own brain. So, yeah.
So how many, I mean, I'm guessing you've had lots and lots of clients that have come to you, because I was one of those people. I didn't come to you. I found you through your amazing book, Keeping the Brain in Mind. Just fantastic. I love it. I went to 3 decades of therapy. Yeah. And I went to someone that doesn't do what you do, but it's similar. And in 3 hours, my life forever changed. So how many patients or clients do you see where they have tried therapy for years or decades, and then they come to you and like in a couple of sessions, they're like, what the heck?
Every client, because the truth is for most of my career, I've been doing this over 25 years. I was training clinicians. So I was seeing other people's patients, psychiatrists. So they've been through the ringer, the therapeutic ringer. By the time they get to me, I am like the last stop on the train. No one says, oh, I have anxiety, I should see a hypnotist. right? They don't think that.
Yeah.
They go to a therapist or they go to a psychiatrist. So unless it's someone who says, I want to quit smoking, and then they think maybe hypnotist. But the truth is, I don't think I've ever met somebody who came to me first, unless someone they love or someone they know very well was one of my clients.
Yeah.
So my last book was on working with kids and teens, and I have a workshop on working with kids and teens coming up on February 10th. So luckily, hopefully, I can get to those kids before they've been kind of cycling through a bunch of different therapeutic modalities, because mine is more about empowering kids to help themselves.
So on that note, you've suggested some critical views on traditional therapy. Can you expand on its limitations and discuss what makes certain modern techniques more effective than what we've seen for the last 100 years?
Well, I think it was you that actually brought up the limitations of traditional therapy.
Maybe. Okay, I'll take that. I'll take that.
Now, remember, I mean, there's a huge, wide range of therapists, and I've been training them for many years. So there's a lot of great and amazing therapists out there.
Absolutely.
The traditional old therapeutic paradigms, where it's just talk about your problems for years and decades, that causes so many problems. If the brain is predictive and you're constantly rehashing and constantly lighting up these old neural networks, right, and adding more into the system, then change is so much harder after that, right? So I believe there's a bunch of different therapeutic modalities I don't agree with, right? I don't agree with you must feel all the pain in order to heal. That's not true. I don't think that you must retell your trauma story over and over and over again, because what you're actually doing is grooving it just a little deeper into the brain. Now, don't get me wrong. There's ways of sharing a traumatic story. And that's when the clinician is fully aware of therapeutic memory reconsolidation and can offer up a different emotional range, a perceptual shift, so that when that trauma gets reconsolidated back into the brain, it has these new emotions or it has these new perspectives. I would say a good therapist is a therapist that is up on the latest neuroscience and that understands the implications of memory reconsolidation. And there's plenty of them now at this point. Not enough for my liking, but I think the main thing about traditional therapeutic models is they're way too slow. And a lot of them don't really give clients tools or techniques to use outside of the therapy room. There's two main things, or this was a while ago, they did this research that kind of indicated the efficacy of a therapeutic modality. And it was the therapeutic rapport, right? And then how well do you teach your clients to regulate their emotional states outside of the therapeutic relationship. And those two things are great predictors. I would add a third. How well do you understand how to reconsolidate hurtful memories?
Well, let's talk about, that's fascinating. Memory reconsolidation is something that I have been studying for just the last couple of months, and I have found it to be like mind-blowingly
fascinating.
It's the game changer. Can you tell us about it?
There's a revolution on its way. And it will change the entire field of mental health once it's fully grasped by the clinicians. That's my hope, right? Because this old idea of how memory works is just not the way memory works. And every time you're remembering something, it becomes malleable, right? And that's just the nature of memory. That's why it changes over time. The metaphor that I use, and now a lot of people use, is that of a Word document. Every time you open a Word document, even if you just add a comma, when you close it, you only ever have access to the latest version. Right? There was a great memory researcher, and he said, the best way to preserve a memory is to never recall it. Mm-hmm. Because each time you recall it, it gets changed.
Wow.
Now, this happens incrementally over time. You don't even feel it. You don't notice it. And that's why you can get together with your family and have big arguments over what did and didn't happen. Because everyone has a slightly different memory of that event. Now, therapeutic memory reconsolidation is where we do the necessary steps to give a massive update. And what we do is we give a massive update. And what typically changes is the emotional track of the memory. so that we can provoke the neural network of that memory. And then what we do is we create the conditions in our sessions to put in what's called a mismatch or a prediction error. It's, I used to be anxious, but she's just done this technique, and now I can get into the elevator and I'm not anxious. In that moment, the brain goes, wait, we need to update, right? Because that old truth is no longer relevant. So in that moment where the brain is predicting, let's say, anxiety or craving or whatever the emotion you want to change, and it gets something different, that's when a fascinating thing happens in the brain. It literally unlocks the memory.
Wow.
And then puts in the new information.
Wow.
So it's fascinating when people, they understand it, they work with it, they get to see that miraculous change like you experienced, where you have one session and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I don't have that anxiety anymore. I don't have that phobia anymore. Somebody comes to me, they've got to do a presentation and they're freaking out because they've never been able to do public speaking. And I make sure to target those memories in a way that shifts them and changes them in that session. And then they do that presentation and feel awesome. That has a cascading effect. You see, because we're not just changing the behavior. There's a lot of therapeutic modalities and people really do hang on to their darlings, the things that they think are important. And a lot of people have argued that, well, that's just superficial change, right? I mean, you have to go deep into the childhood to find out why. And it's like, you know what? That superficial change, what you think is superficial, changes that person's life, number one. But if that neural network is hooked into all the past incidents from early childhood on, as well as the beliefs that come with thinking, I am not good enough. I can't do this. Everyone else seems to be able to speak up in the boardroom, right? So they have low self-esteem. They have no confidence. They have beliefs about their limitations, beliefs about what other people think about them. That's all tied into the same system. We change that one piece so that they can now be comfortable in their skin, speaking up in front of an audience. That changes their belief about themselves. It changes their limitations. It changes how they feel about the people they're with and how they feel the people they're with are judging or not judging them. That plays into a whole schema. So I recently wrote a post on how we're all right. We can all be right. Regardless of your therapeutic angle, once you understand we're all operating on the same neural network, we're just coming at it from different ways, right? It's the old elephant, right? Everybody's got hanging on to a piece of the elephant. They're blind and they're saying, oh, this is what an elephant is like. And one person has the tail and says, oh, I think an elephant is quite skinny with a funny little. And so I try to bring the therapeutic world together because there's so many factions. And one of my favorite hypnotists, Milton Erickson, he had this great quote and he said, therapists can't afford the luxury of a theory. And I love that.
So you've said so many great things. So one thing leads to many is what I think I heard you say. So someone will come to you with one issue, anxiety. And once you solve that, it changes everything. I've seen that over and over and over again. Someone will come to me with a racing mind and we'll do the work. And then they'll be like, my relationship with my kids and my wife is so much better. I'm earning more money. It's such an amazing thing.
Nothing exists in a vacuum, right? We are not as compartmentalized as many people think.
So the example of the speaker. So someone is really, really afraid to get up and speak in front of the boardroom or in front of the crowd. My understanding is that is a symptom that is keeping them from feeling something that may be even more painful. Can you give us an example of what that underlying thing could be that's leading them to have the anxiety when they speak?
So I'm going to push against that assumption. While it can be true and nothing exists in a vacuum and we are the accumulation of all that we have lived, our beliefs, our expectations, our experiences, right? So that maybe that child, anytime they went to speak up at home, we could go back to an early attachment style, right? They were just not given that much attention. Or maybe it was you got called up in front of the class when they were very young in first grade and didn't know the answer. And they looked out and saw the kids and felt like the kids were laughing at them or judging. So that the brain drops a flag in that moment and says, this doesn't feel safe. And then the next time the kid gets called up, all of a sudden starts to feel anxious. He doesn't even know why. That's because the brain is saying, we don't like to do this. Let's not do this. right? This threatens our system a little bit. I'm going to do it. And so you're forced to do it. That feels uncomfortable. It reconfirms the situation. And then all of a sudden it becomes the next year. The kid raises their hand and everyone turns to see, and that re-triggers the same thing. And now, right? So we can easily see the path of how the brain generalizes that to now being in a boardroom. That's just experience. I wouldn't necessarily say it is a symptom of something deeper and darker. It is just a symptom of life. You could say, okay, well, maybe you feel you're not good enough, or maybe this, or maybe that. But I would venture to say that that is a conscious rationalization from what an unconscious system just does automatically, because that's what it's been trained to do, right? It's predictive. So quite often you will have situations where the unconscious mind will make a decision. Almost every decision you make, by the way, is mediated first through unconscious processing. And then typically the conscious mind will rationalize it or create a narrative to go with that.
So, Melissa, maybe I misspoke. This is how I read or understand Bruce Eckhart, is that maybe I'm using the wrong terminology, but if it's an addiction or anxiety or whatever the client wants to change, isn't that kind of, isn't it protection against something that they feel if they didn't have it would be worse in their life?
It can be, yes. Not always.
Not always. Okay.
Not always. So you will never hear me say something is always this or that, simply because there's exceptions all the time. And if you go in with that filter on, then you're looking in a direction that is going to be skewed, right? There is the can't afford the luxury of a theory, you see. If you look at every single behavior as symptomatic of something much deeper, then you're going to spend a lot of time, sometimes years, looking for that deeper thing. And then if you don't have tools to clear it, if you're just looking and picking around in the past, looking for deeper hurts, you're going to find them, because that's called life and growing up, right? Now, that being said, I do understand, because I developed an addiction protocol. I myself have been addicted to various drugs during my life. I used to be a rock and roll musician. It just came with the territory. Sometimes the addiction is self-soothing, and it is, yes, keeping you from facing the demons in your life. Think about, there was this great Rat Park study. Did you ever hear of that?
I've heard of it. I couldn't recite it, but I've certainly heard.
So it basically talks about our original views of addiction. We all heard about the rat put in the cage, and he had two choices, food or cocaine or something, right? And what they found was that rat in a cage would always go for the cocaine until they died. And it was like, see, that's how addictive it is. But somebody came along and they created a rat park. And now they put the rat in a bigger cage with a bunch of toys and other rats, and they can play and they could fool around. And they had just had a lot going on, and the cocaine and the food. And it was very rare, a rare time when they would hit the drug. So what they said basically is, if you put people in a cage where the cocaine is the only way out mentally, right? We need a bigger cage. We need a better cage.
Wow.
And so the Vietnam vets who were all addicted to heroin, we thought when they were coming home, there would be an epidemic of heroin addicted vets. But the truth is, a very small percentage of those vets went on to continue being addicted to heroin. Most of them realized that we had changed the cage that they were in.
Wow, that is fascinating.
So, I mean, I say that just because, yes, it can be symptomatic of something deeper, or you could just get addicted to drugs because drugs are fun and they feel good, and you did one too many, or you did it too many days in a row, and now your body is kind of dependent on it. And then the problem itself becomes the fact that you're addicted to drugs and not the problem that you were running away from.
Mm. So. Wow. Fascinating, fascinating, fascinating. Incredibly. So in your book, Keeping the Brain in Mind, I'm actually going to use it here on an exercise with a client. You talk about fully rehearsing the client's working memory so they can get the behavior that they actually want. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works?
Well, I mean, there's many ways that we can do that. I teach self-hypnosis template to every client, which is really fast, right? So that they can do this think about athletes doing mental rehearsal, right? But you add a little hypnosis to the mix and it's a little bit more powerful. could be a little shorter as well. And that is being able to not just see yourself doing this thing, right, which might trigger certain areas in the brain, but to float in and actually embody it. And that's where the brain starts to light up the regions as if you're actually doing it. That's why most Olympic athletes know how to do this, right? We're rehearsing it. We're taking the brain through it. And also, if you think about the brain running on prediction, the prediction doesn't necessarily have to be in real life. It could be in your mind, which is why people can have a terrible fear of flying that have never been on a plane. They just sit there on their couch imagining how horrifying it would be, and they're rehearsing it. And so it creates an automatic, unconscious reaction, fight or flight reaction. Fight or flight, that's unconsciously mediated. You can't instigate it consciously. You can do the things that you know might trigger it, but it's mediated through the unconscious system. So teaching people different ways to rehearse how they want to be. But also it shows you how, as you started with, the good and the bad, right? Because think about when people are anxious or worry about something. I always say, look at the self-hypnosis you're already using, right? Look at the self-hypnosis you're already using. What are you saying to yourself repeatedly? What are you picturing or worrying about repeatedly? Because repetition gets in. It also affects the prediction aspect of the brain.
So if I'm rehearsing, oh my gosh, when I call this client, they're going to laugh at me or hang up on me. And I don't like to make that call. And it is a part of my success in my job, right? We're rehearsing those bad things. But what you teach is to see everything in a different light. When I call that person, what do I feel? I feel confident. I feel secure. What do you see? What do you hear? And your point is, you know, they've done studies where they had weightlifters lift weights. And then they had another group that just thought about lifting weights. And the people who thought about lifting weights, their muscle mass increased. It was incredible.
Yeah, they've done that. They've done studies like that with piano players, with violin players, right? Stroke victims who are bedridden. It's one of the key ways of getting them to remind their body, their brain, how to function. So we do this all the time. Unfortunately, most people do this in a negative way. As you said, we make projections. We're like, oh, they're going to laugh at me. They're going to judge me. They're not going to want to hear from me, or I'm not going to be able to remember my lines, whatever it is, right? And so, yeah, front loading that by, quite often with my clients, I'll say, milk the future, right? Like, fantasize about the future you want. So let's just imagine we go back to your example where you have to make this call, this sales call or something, right? Imagine that this person really benefited from that conversation, because as I always, because I've trained people in this as well, a no just means a no, just means not a yes yet, right? On many different levels. And so if you go in with feeling comfortable in your skin and confident and optimistic, that energy is going to be absolutely conveyed, right? And so what that means is you're going to approach that call in a way that the other person feels it. Because they're going to feel it. We, you and I, even now, over this medium, we're sharing millions of bits of information.
So you mentioned Olympic athletes. I watched last year the Tiger Woods documentary. People used to always say, man, that guy was just in a flow. He was in a zone. And in the documentary, it talks about his dad was in the military, obviously, and he had a buddy of his that was playing golf with him who happened to be a hypnotist in one of the branches of the military. And he taught Tiger Woods how to hypnotize himself. So when Tiger Woods was just like ruling the tour and he was in that like focus zone, he was hypnotized.
Yes, he was. So it was a lot. You know, many. Michael Phelps uses hypnosis all the time. Like, these are people that understand the mental aspect of the game, not just to control your emotional state and to feed into your expectations and beliefs, but to rehearse the brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we talked about memory reconsolidation, and then I think I pulled us down another track, but it is so amazing the power that it has. Can you explain it like I'm a seventh grader? How, just exactly what goes on and why is it different and how long have we known about it?
I mean, well, we've known about it in a few different ways, right? But typically not we as in coaches or hypnotists or clinicians. They've been, I think it goes back to Joseph Ledoux's NYU lab and Daniela Schiller, and it was about fear and changing fear memories in rats. Don't get me started on poor rats, but whatever. So Bruce Ecker, as you mentioned, is one of the people that was kind of pivotal in translating from the laboratory into the therapeutic room and simplifying it down, right? So it's only been kind of available in the therapeutic realm, I would say probably for like 10 years. I could be wrong. I don't remember when Bruce Ecker's book came out.
I think it was around 2005, 2007.
Okay. All right. So a little longer than 10
it's
years.
Still short, right? In the grand scheme of things.
In the grand scheme of things, yes. And there's been a lot more clinicians on board, I would say, in the past 5 years, where it's kind of reached that tipping point in certain circles. I've been doing my part. I've been teaching about memory reconsolidation at conferences for years now, because I think it's key. It's important, especially for hypnotists, especially for coaches who are doing more brief strategic work, right? They don't typically, a hypnotist is not going to see a person for 2 decades. That's a bad hypnotist.
Yeah.
Sorry. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, but basically the simplest way is how I kind of explained it before. When you target a memory, and whether that is getting right up against the thing that triggers it, right? This is a format that I teach in my coaching course, as well as in my hypnosis training, which is how to get someone very close to the trigger so that we can make sure that it's lit up. See, this is where a lot of things go wrong. If you just assume because someone's talking about something that the memory, the neural network of the memory is actually lit up, that's making a big assumption. It could be right, but it also could be wrong. So I train coaches and therapists to make sure that they understand how to use language in such a way as to make sure that memory is lit up. Once it's lit up, it becomes malleable. Then we do a bunch of different things. We interrupt it. We start to add in how they want to feel instead. Maybe we use certain techniques that kind of reduce the fear or the anxiety first, and then we put in and start to rehearse how they want to feel. And then we bring that to the trigger. And in that moment where they're feeling confident, and now they imagine stepping on that stage or into that boardroom or signing on to that Zoom meeting, and they're feeling confident, that's when the brain takes notice. That's the prediction error, and that's when it updates. Then I use more traditional neuroplasticity to condition it in. So I use the 2 different types really in every session. One is memory reconsolidation. The other is what we would call counteractive neuroplasticity, which is the conditioning aspect, creating maybe alternative roads. So I kind of use them both together in a way that creates a bit faster change.
So considering the effectiveness of neuroplasticity and memory reconsolidation, why do you think those techniques are not more widely used by therapists?
Well, they're not known. Most curriculums are not there yet as far as educating therapists. I mean, my daughter is in graduate school right now, and sometimes when she tells me what she's learning, I just want to smash my head against the wall, but they're still learning some very outdated things. But that's one angle, is that it's just not known. I know therapists, and if they're given something that will help their clients faster and easier, they're going to take it. They just don't know it exists because it's not being taught. Now we can go for the deeper, not so nice answer to that, which is who funds all the research?
Pharmaceutical companies?
That's right, honey.
Huh.
So there is research on memory reconsolidation, but it's the pills, right? There's a lot of research on how do we change this through a pill form, and they've been studying that, but not how do we do it in a behavioral way, in a therapeutic way. But that's just life, like the same thing. Now, hypnosis is different in that we've had hundreds of years worth of studies and research on it. But even still, recently on Instagram, I said, what's the first thing that pops into your mind when you hear the word hypnosis? And still, we've got the old ideas of mind control, swinging watches. No one has updated it.
Chasing a mouse.
Quick Google search, right? Hypnosis research. Hundreds of papers.
Do you think the fact that the pharmaceutical companies provide so much of their research in neuroscience and psychology, that that's a reason why close to 33% of Americans are on an antidepressant or anti-anxiety drug right now?
I mean, yes, there's other factors as well. We're inundated with that. We're primed to believe that some people still believe that it's a chemical imbalance. We know that's not true. They can't prove it. They've tried to prove it for so long. They've spent billions of dollars trying to prove it. It's not true. And yet, we're still acting as if. So there's the fact that the pharmaceutical industry is a big industry. It funds the research. But also, we live in a world where we'd rather take a fucking pill. Sorry. I was so good about cursing. We'd rather take a pill, right? People, it's like, oh, you know what? You can exercise. Exercise beats out antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication every single time, every single study. But people would rather take the pill than actually exercise. Meditation. Meditation's been known to allow you to control your emotional states and focusing abilities, but you'd rather take ADD and anti-anxiety med. So it's the pharmaceutical industry, it's the priming, but it's also our want of a magic bullet and not wanting to do the work. And that's why, I mean, all of my techniques that I teach, I honed my system, my therapeutic system on New Yorkers. So everything I teach can be done in under a minute because I know that is what people will do rather than do a self-hypnosis thing for 35, 40 minutes. They're not going to do it. So my self-hypnosis template's 2 minutes.
Yeah, I wonder if the fact that people are so conditioned to want to take a pill over meditating or exercising is because of them, or is it because they go to what they see as a medical professional who has 15 years of education and practice, and that's what they're told? Like, hey.
No, I think it's both. I think it's both. So yes, obviously not just the medical practitioner, but the entire culture that we live in, right? We are being primed every single moment. Every single moment we are being primed. Our unconscious mind is being manipulated all the time. It can't not be. And so there is that factor. But there's also people have been told by their doctor, their cardiologist, exercise and stop eating so much red meat. People are told what they should do. They know they should do it. I just heard about someone who opted for a medical procedure rather than change their diet. So I think we can't lay all the blame on the establishment, yeah. Although we can lay most of it. Yeah. But the other is just that we are in a culture that doesn't value certain things. We value productivity. We value go get it, go get yours. That type of culture we live in poo-poos something like having a meditation practice in the morning, right? That's a fringe. That's a very fringe part of our culture, which values that.
So Melissa, as we wrap up here, I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball and ask you, what's the greatest lesson you've learned in your life?
Oh my God. The greatest lesson? Jeez. You're going to wrap up with that quick little question? All right. Well, I did just write something that I think is helpful, and that is looking at life as your graduate school, right? So anytime I go into certain types of regret, right? Regret of those years that I lost through addiction or that, I look at it instead as, what did I learn from that, right? If I hadn't done that, if I didn't go through that particular major or minor, I wouldn't have been able to help thousands of people by creating my addiction protocol. Yeah. If I didn't experience chronic pain for so many years, I wouldn't have developed my chronic pain protocol. Life as graduate school, what can we learn from this? I have trained so many people who come to my training for a second chance, for a new career sometimes, or just an infusion into their therapeutic practice. And once you start to realize that the very thing they struggled with is now the thing that they excel at.
Yeah.
With helping people. I mean, you yourself, you're an example of that, correct?
Yeah.
So I would say that's a big lesson.
Love it. And you can live your life the same way because everything happens for you and not to you. So if you think you're going through bad times, it's just, there's a lesson in there. Melissa, this was fantastic. How can people reach you?
You can look for Melissa Tears on Instagram. You can go to melissatears.com. That's how. And then my email, things like that. I have some classes coming up for practitioners they might be interested in.
And Melissa's two S's and Tears is T-I-E-R-S.
Yes.
So that was phenomenal. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
And I wanted to remind everyone, I'm on a mission here to help 1 million people. So I need your help. So if you like this content, please share it. Please rate it. Please review it. Anything you can do to get this word out. And as we wrap up, just want to remind you that love heals all. Thanks, Melissa.
See ya.
Hit subscribe if you don't want to miss out on more life-changing content. And if you're struggling, you don't have to. Go to bradchandler.com/contact. There, you can join the Facebook community of like-minded entrepreneurs, and you'll see a button to schedule your freedom and happiness call. See you on the next episode.